This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Tia Vasiliou, and this is not an interview. For episode 5, it's even less of an interview than these usually are. I have a few cocktails with Jason Latour, writer, artist, and creator of Southern Bastards, Spider-Gwen, and lots more amazing books you can find linked in the show notes. Because this was recorded in a public place, there's some background noise and some audio quirks, but, you know, we're just going to roll with it. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
All right, fuck it. It's as good as I'm going to get.
All right.
I never firmly felt the stereotype. I never really felt like I was, like, the nerdy weirdo, even though I was. I had less shame about it, maybe, but I think because there was so many there's a massive disconnect, I think, between, it's a generational gap, and it has a lot to do with how ubiquitous these ideas are.
Right. Do you think it's because of the movies?
It has a lot to do with it. There's a lot of kids and younger people who are in their 20s, teens, early 30s, who the Marvel movies are now over 10 years old.
I know. When was the first Iron Man?
I think it's 11 years ago.
Wow.
So if you're 22 now, you are 11 when Iron Man came out.
That's right? Formative.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you grow up in a world where you see the biggest corporation, Disney, in the world, has movies that make billions of dollars and products that spin out of that and seem accepted by everyone.
You know what I would add to that is social media and web comics.
Yes.
Because comics are all over Tumblr, and it's so easy to just go on Gumroad or Kickstarter or whatever and just like find the comics that you like. That doesn't seem like it was a thing 10 or 15 years ago. Maybe. I don't
think it was. And I feel like there was a certain degree of, I have friends who are very open-minded people who are my age who have expressed that, like, when Scott Pilgrim came out, they read it on a bus and they were ashamed to be reading a comic on the bus.
Yeah.
And it's an age gap. It's a generational thing. And it has everything to do with the fact that, like, older people, right or wrong, feel like they had to be protective of this space.
Yeah.
And of course that becomes toxic sometimes.
Yeah. Because it becomes stifling.
Yes, because for a lot of these people, that was the only thing that, you know, gave them a release or a form of entertainment or whatever.
Yeah.
It gave them an authorship in their life. And to see that change without their consent has to be existential upheaval.
But isn't it spectacularly narcissistic that rather than being like, here's the next generation of people who feel that way, and I want them to have what I had, they're like, fuck you guys, we're slamming the gate shut.
Yes. I mean, for me, it was as simple as, like, I just wanted to have... I would go to these comic conventions when I was a kid, and one, I mean, take the idea of seeing a girl there out of it. I just wanted to have friends that like this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I've joked about it in several interviews I've done this weekend with people, that when I was a kid, if you met a dude who liked comics or another person that liked comics, they were 50-50, they were either going to be your best friend or your mortal enemy.
Which one was more exciting?
You were either like, I'm going to have this person around all the time, or I don't want to ever see this person again. Which maybe hasn't changed, but the sample size is so much bigger, you know, that it allows for a gradation.
I only read one comic when I was a kid, which was ElfQuest.
I skipped over that. Not for disinterest, but just, again, I don't know why, actually.
You should read it.
Yeah?
I mean, it taught me everything about orgies that I ever wanted to know at the age of, like, you know, 11. But, like, I mean, I say that jokingly. It honestly was probably the first media that I ever was exposed to that had different types of relationships and sexualities, and the characters were kind of a little bit more complicated. The themes were a little, there wasn't a good and a bad.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And Wendy and Richard, I think, have talked about how the reason they don't ever really move that far when their work gets optioned for TV or movies or whatever is because they always want to really boil it down to, like, and here's the bad guy and here's the good guy, and that's just not what they're doing.
That's weird in a Game of Thrones era.
Well,
you know?
Yeah. But for when I was a kid, having that was really interesting. And it was also something that I only did with my friends. Like, we had one copy and we would read it together. So yeah. For me, it was always a very social experience. And it's really sad to me when I meet people who are like, I sat alone and I read comics, and that just wasn't my experience at all.
I was fortunate that I enjoyed the solitude of it. Mm-hmm. Like, it became a thing that I liked doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would go visit my grandparents or my grandmother. My grandmother was a mother's mother, had a stroke in her 50s. So my mom was from rural North Carolina, and so my mom, because of her mother's condition, was trying to remain close to her family, even though she had moved away. So she would make sure that our whole family, at least once a month, would go spend a weekend in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Where there's two fucking channels. And to this day, that's why I love the Golden Girls. Oh. And that's why it's weird to me that basically going to Crawl County might have been the thing that opened my mind to something as, like, progressive as Golden Girls.
Right.
You know, just by virtue of, like, there's a show my mom liked, and it was on television, so I had to watch it. Mm-hmm. And as a result, like, a lot of crazy ideas.
No.
The crazy for a person from where I was from.
Right.
Sort of, like, worked their way into my head. And, but reading comics, especially, like, during the winter, you would go during the winter. You know, during the summer, you could go traipse around outside or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, play basketball on the dirt clod basketball court. or throw baseballs against the barn kind of bullshit.
Okay. And we had very different upbringings.
Chase my brother through the woods with a knife.
Wow. No, I definitely did that.
Reading comics was kind of how I...
Don't say anything profound until the ambulance goes by.
If I'm ever going to say anything profound, it'll probably be while an ambulance goes by. While I'm in an ambulance. reading comics was how I escaped and stayed present at the same time.
That's exactly what I used them for, just later in life.
Yeah, sure. And it was... But for me, I was always actively interested in making.
Right.
So I think that's probably why I was a little more open-minded about the idea of, like, oh, I want to pass this down to people. Maybe it was subconscious, but, like, mm-hmm. the fact that it was a career.
You didn't go to art school, right?
No. I say it like it's a fucking point of pride sometimes, but it's really not.
Oh, no, I mean, I'm not saying it in any kind of, like...
I was too fucking...
It's a neutral question, basically.
I was too fucking cocky to go to art school.
It's an informational question.
I was way too cocky to go to art school.
Mm-hmm.
I had spent a lot of time going to Heroes Con every summer. All I wanted to do was tell stories.
You're clearly not worse for wear because you didn't go to art school.
I think this comes up a lot, and it's a hard thing for me to wrestle. I still wrestle with
really?
It. But yeah, because I don't regret where I am. And I think I am better. I think the path I took is the path I took.
Yeah.
And that had I not taken it, it's egotistical on some level because I have to believe I'm good. So this whole argument for me not going to art school has to stem from a place that says I'm better than I would have been, which is an unknowable thing.
I don't think you have to say you're better than you would have been. Like, why isn't it fine to just say that you're good now? And you took a certain path and you got here and it's a good place.
I think what makes me, if there's one thing I can put my finger on that makes me good, is that I know that I have a mode between being fallible and completely confident. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm 100% confident that it's okay for me to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I know when I'm giving myself a pass rather than giving my best. And so I always try to work to give my best. And, you know, when I was younger, that was the thing I could not do, was give myself a break.
Right.
But because I couldn't give myself a break, I developed a lot more, there was a lot more intensity to my development as an artist. Mm-hmm. And it took me letting go to get anywhere.
I think that at certain stages, these things work better. So just speaking as a coach.
Yeah, sure.
You know, there's a point at which I need my dancer to forget all of the technique and all of the corrections and just listen to the music and dance. But there's also times when I need her to forget about dancing for a minute and do the conditioning that I'm telling her to do that fucking sucks, but that she needs to do.
I was going to ask you about sports.
Yeah, let's talk about sports. No one ever wants to talk
about competition.
Sports. Yeah.
Because that is a big theory I have about...
Tell me.
I say this all the time to people, that it doesn't seem to like register with people who've never played a sport, which is basically when you're in a game or you're in a competition, if you've prepared well enough, if you've practiced long enough, that's how you get to a place where you just are playing.
Right.
And that is the most comparable thing to art. An art that's based on craft, or has any component of craft to it. Mm-hmm. You might be some abstract artist that doesn't believe in craft, and that's a whole nother discussion. But in comics, there's a fundamental need to communicate, and that alone is
yes.
a craft.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And that can come in a thousand different ways, and you can get to that point a thousand different ways. Mm-hmm. But what's most essential is knowing that, I think. And then practicing whatever you need to practice so that when you play, you actually are in the moment and sort of reacting. You know, it's jazz, not math, to mix the metaphors.
You cannot be in the moment and trust your body and trust your instincts if you haven't honed your skills.
Right.
You have nothing to fall back, like, you have nothing to trust.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like,
you danced competitively.
Yes, but I hate performing.
Okay.
So
that's a problem.
I don't like people dancing. Watching me dance.
Okay.
Also, I was never physically put together right for dancing. My feet are terrible. I am a little too heavy. My legs are not turned out. I'm too curvy. And so if I wanted to be credible at all, I really had to fucking hack this, like, every last thing that I could to maximize my, like, faking it so people would believe that I should be there. Nothing came easy to me. Nothing.
Competitive dance is also weird because it is a competition, but much like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but much like something like figure skating, there's basically who wins and loses is an art competition. It's subjective.
So I like to call these kind of sports connoisseurial sports.
Yeah.
Because there are objective criteria. And the judges are expected to know the objective criteria and be able to recognize it when it's presented to them and be able to recognize attempts, like gestures toward those things, and be able to grade how close they got to achieving those things. That's connoisseurship.
To me, that sounds like everything I'm guilty of when I look at a comic book artist.
Yeah.
And everything I hate about other comic book artists when they look at people's work is like there's a myth that everything is, that there is objectivity in art.
So here's, right, yes, obviously. But there, but you could say, for example, I'm going to award this piece of art 5 points if the colors of the sky closely resemble the colors of a real sky at this time and place. That's a comparison that you can make.
I could go, I'm like,
I know, you
so
hate this.
Tempted to you want to like this. Go like super.
Okay, actually, let's forget like, art. Let's go to football for a second.
Well, that's the thing, is that like, I think football is like crazy subjective in a lot of ways. That's what drives me crazy about watching it now.
I know nothing about football that I didn't. All I know I learned from Friday Night Lights, okay? So, probably nothing.
Okay, so, like, there's a big thing in football about, especially televised sports.
Yeah.
About, like, what's a catch? What's the rule? What point does this count versus at what point does it not? And this is probably gonna be jibber jabber, but
break it down.
At any point when you're watching Monday Night Football, for example, there's always like a catch which they will go to instant replay and say, you will inevitably hear the announcers argue back and forth over like, we're 2 feet down. Did he have the ball in his hands? Like that whole crazy
Pause.
Thing.
Back up just a little bit. Tell me what would make someone question a catch.
In the NFL, you have to secure the ball, like whatever that means.
Okay, so that's not defined as secure.
You have to secure the ball,
okay,
have both feet on the ground, inbounds,
okay,
and make a quote-unquote football move. And then from there...
What's a football move?
Exactly.
Okay.
Most of the time, people define it as like moving in the direction that I would assume that it means you're moving in a direction which would lead to a score, because
okay,
that's what the ultimate goal of
sure
the offense is.
Right.
But if a guy like moves backwards or like moves sideways or whatever, you know, then it gets really...
That could be a football move, because what if there's like a reason he can't move forward?
Yes. So usually okay the debates come about like, is the guy bobbling the ball?
If it is determined that you did not make the catch, what happens?
Ball goes back to...
So there's stakes?
Yes.
Okay.
Like, big stakes.
And this is a subjective call someone has to make based on what they observe.
It's a call that should be completely objective, but because the language has become mm-hmm so much like legalese, that people will debate over meanings of things that are...
In gymnastics, it's like exactly the same, right? Like, you are, when you do a split leap, if you don't hit 180 degree split, you are supposed to get any number of deductions.
Yeah.
Also, they might not even give you credit for doing a split leap, because a split leap is 180 degrees. So they could say, well, you attempted a split leap, but your legs didn't reach 180, so we're just going to give you a deduction.
Somebody like run out with a fucking protractor?
No, that's the thing. There is no protractor. In some, like, I think SEC Network has graphics where they'll put the protractor up.
Yeah, I don't believe any of that shit.
But like, no, the judges just have to make the call.
See, this is, maybe everything else up to this point has been unusable about, but this is the thing that I had to get over.
People making subjective
judgments? No, coming into art is that I viewed things too objectively.
Uh-huh.
I thought that like life was about winning and losing.
Isn't it?
No, I don't think it is. I think that if you view life about... I think people are paradoxical, and I can firmly want to win all the time, but know that at the end of the day, it's impossible to sometimes know if I won, or that as a pursuit is too binary, you know? Like, if I said to someone that my engagement in sport was only good because I was good, because I wasn't very good.
What sports did you play?
I played competitively a lot of football, and then I got into basketball as I got older. Mm-hmm. And much like when I was young, playing basketball was not very good. And then, like, towards the end of college and afterwards, I got to be where I felt like I was pretty fucking good.
Yeah.
And I can look back at the time before that and say I was bad. But I worked really hard at it because I enjoyed it. But like you, I didn't have the body for it.
Right.
You know, I'm 5'11", you know?
It makes you better, though. People who are just like naturally good, they've never had to think about it. They've never had to be critical about what they're doing. So the minute something goes wrong for them, they have no idea what to do.
Well, that's a really good segue into like talking about privilege, but... I had to get over the idea. Well, what I'm trying to say is that if I only viewed the time I spent engaging in that stuff as like, was I good at it?
Mm-hmm.
Then I didn't really learn anything from it, and I didn't really get anything out of it. Because ultimately, like, where was I going to go with it?
Where'd you want to go with it?
Exactly. That's why it's not wins and losses. You know, because. To me, the journey is more important than the destination, even though the destination is very important to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the destination doesn't mean anything if I think the journey is more important.
I have a hard time getting my students to buy into that because they have every disadvantage. Like, they're from a small town. The studio that we have is smaller than every stage we compete on. When every single competition, the judges give us a note that we don't use the whole stage. And I'm like, if you could see where these girls have to practice, like, they're doing great, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't win that often. And I try to tell them, the judges only see that moment, and they don't know what you've done to get there.
Right.
But I know what you've done to get there.
And you know.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but...
I find that as a really, you know, because my career in art or whatever, I was in the desert for a long time. I didn't even, like, make a living in any way, shape, or form until my early 30s after trying to do this from the time I was a little kid. And now that doesn't mean that it's a sob story. I got my own way a lot, and I had a lot of advantages that I didn't take. And maybe I should have. And maybe some I got that I didn't see. But at the end of the day, what like I learned through all of this is that, like, much like losing a tough game or something, that if I go out there and give it my all, I know that. And it's really hard when you're an artist sometimes to put everything into something and you expect an outcome.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that even in success, you get outcomes that you didn't.
Do you ever feel like when this happens that, like, is your first thought they didn't get it, or is your first thought I didn't get it?
As I've gotten older, I've gotten to the point where I'm okay with feeling like someone didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have learned that I have to think about it like it might have been me. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I remember early on, like, one of the first things I ever worked on, some review gave, just ripped me apart. And I remember the time thinking, like, this guy doesn't know what they're talking about. And then 4 or 5 years later, it came across, you know, my screen again, and I reread it, and I was like, that guy was right. You know, he may have been an asshole about the way he said it.
Yeah.
But that guy was more right than I wanted to admit. Mm-hmm. You know? And it really wasn't until, as a person that always wanted to win and be good and... It's toxic to only look at winning as, like, one outcome.
If your goal is winning, I think you miss a lot along the way. And you might still win. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's because my sports are more subjective. But
yeah,
I just,
it feels like you got to wrestle with it being hard.
Well, yeah. And also, it's like, that's what they saw in that moment on that day. It doesn't mean that that's you as a person. Do you know, the root of the word agony is agon, which is the Greek word for contest, which I find very interesting.
Okay.
Because I don't believe that in order to be competitive, you have to suffer. And I think a lot of sports and arts still buy into this idea that you have to suffer to be good.
Yeah, I don't believe that either, but I think you have to have a relationship to suffering, if that makes sense. Like, you have to have, like...
Tell me more.
No, I think you have to have felt it at some point. Mm-hmm. To have empathy for somebody else.
Of course, especially the kind of art that you do, which is storytelling.
Yeah.
You know?
And to also, you have to have felt agony at some point so that you don't want to feel it again. You know?
And you have to be able to...
Or be willing to feel it again.
You have to know how to perform when you're fucking up. Like, okay, so... And I'm going to go back to gymnastics because that's the sport that I am most conversant in. But it's like, it used to be back in the day when they used the 10, like, out of the scoring system where the highest score was a 10. If you fell or stepped out of bounds, it was done for you. You're done. And now, because the scoring system is a little more complex, you could still win if you fall. Because there's an execution score, but then you also kind of get rewarded for the difficulty that you attempt. I don't know. I mean, or even with my students. Like, one of my girls, she found out she was the only person competing in her category.
Okay.
And she was so upset. And she was like, it doesn't matter what I do. Fuck it. So she goes out on stage, forgets her routine, like, you know, has a complete meltdown. And it's like, you have to know how to perform and keep going, even after you think you already lost it.
Yes. Is that why you live in New York? Just because you have a relationship to agony?
Everything is agonizing.
Because that's a gear shift, but that question is important to me.
Why I live in New York?
No. Why anyone is. Because to me...
Duress?
It was agony.
Yeah.
And I fucking loved it. And maybe it's because I'm a masochist.
I am a masochist. But I am also very claustrophobic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's different.
I know.
But... I just mean, like, for me, it's like, I was here dead broke.
Right.
But it was the most formative, one of the most formative art experiences I ever had. And so as a result, I still feel comfortable here and I love it, even though I fucking had the worst time here.
The hardest thing to do as an artist is be in New York. Because in order to live and make enough money to live, you have to do a lot of things that aren't art.
You don't think that's just like America?
I mean, probably, but like, if that's the case, go live in Arkansas, where the rent is like a quarter of the rent in New York.
This is a thing I've talked to a lot of like Southern artists about, is like, you know, the people in your town don't give a shit about you unless the people in New York or San Diego, Comic-Con or
Yeah, but the internet is here to make the New
Well,
York
right, and
about
that's
you.
The debate.
Yeah.
That's kind of why I'm asking the question, because I keep asking people, like, what do they think the pro and the con of living in a place like this in the modern era is?
Yeah.
You know, because you really don't need it as much. But
when you
maybe
lived here, did you go to the Met? Did you go to MoMA?
I didn't know.
Did you go? Then what was the point?
I went to the subway.
What was the
point?
And
I went to the park.
Right.
And that was the museum. And like, that was like, I learned how to observe because I was so broke that like, for fun, I would do life drawing.
Okay, fair.
And I mean, I don't mean to sound defensive about
no,
it.
No, it's just, okay. It's really your, that's a perfectly valid point.
I just, like, when you draw somebody, you spend a lot of time. You know, this is the thing that, like, I've always had, like, such a self-generated imagination.
Yeah.
That to get better at art, I needed to have something to push it against.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of similar to the idea of having a relationship with agony. Or you said earlier when we were just talking on the way over here, you have to try things you're not good at.
Yeah.
So one thing that I didn't have a lot of experience at was I didn't know how to draw people in a proper way. Mm-hmm. And I set out to try and learn how to do that, but with the bent that, like, I'm going to use one tool because comics is about making choices.
Right.
It's not about me trying to like be, for me it wasn't. It wasn't about me trying to recreate reality. It was about me trying to find a way to use reality to tell a better story.
Absolutely.
So every person I drew, I had to like go through this whole sort of like back and forth over like, are they paying attention? Are they not? You know.
If they were, would you stop?
Sometimes. The best, and sometimes not. The craziest story about it was one time I was on the subway, and I was going from, I lived in Crown Heights in like 2006.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty rough area at the time. And late at night especially would be kind of touch and go.
Yeah.
And so like one night I was on the subway, and I was in Manhattan that night, so it was about a 45 minute hour ride to where I lived. And about the last 30 minutes, 20 minutes of it, it's just me and this dude that looks like my looper. So it's like a homeless dude with like, homeless white dude with a goatee, and he looks like somebody shit on his chest, and like he's the dustiest looking dude I've ever seen. And he's sitting across from me, and I'd been drawing everybody on the train, and I was just kind of in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I was weirdly using a pencil that night, which is something I rarely do.
Mm-hmm.
And
what do you normally do?
About the last 15 minutes of the thing, he just starts staring right into me from across the, almost like a game of chicken.
Yeah.
And we hit like a stop about two stops before mine, and he stood up and started to walk straight towards me.
Yeah.
And I flipped my pencil around in my hand like a prison shank and was like, I'm about to have to kill this dude. I'm about to have to kill future me. The best part would have been if I had stabbed him and killed him, and he would have been like, don't go into comics.
And
he reached right underneath me and pulled a bag of used chicken.
Oh my, no.
So it was like a Popeye's chicken.
Why does every weird New York story involve chicken?
So he pops back onto his side of the ride, and the rest of the ride is like eating this chicken bone, just having a fucking grand old time. And when the doors opened, I got off that train like, have you ever seen that meme of Homer going into the bushes?
Yeah.
I straight like stood up and like.
My weirdest New York story also involves chicken. It's not nearly as weird as that, but I was at the New York City Ballet, and this woman sitting next to me is wearing this like really elaborate fur coat.
Yeah.
And then during intermission, she pulls some fried chicken out and just starts eating it in the theater.
Fried chicken is fucking delicious.
You do not bring food in the theater.
Even if you're hungry?
No.
That's why I can't get down with your art form. Maybe that's why ballet didn't catch on in the South as much.
Because you can't eat chicken. Okay, but in Saratoga Springs, in upstate New York, which I will not go to this venue because I disapprove of this entirely. It's like baseball stadium seating with like plastic cup holders, and it's all like outdoor. And I went to see the Bolshoi there. The dancers are being dive bombed by like mosquitoes throughout the entire performance. Unacceptable.
Why?
That is not why you go to the ballet. You do not go to the ballet to see Don Quixote tilting at mosquitoes.
I just feel like, I feel you, but at the same level, I'm like, I'm such a believer in like art being
accessible.
Yes.
I agree. However,
that seems like an art form that really needs to be.
No, it totally does. But why do people think that something is not for them because it's fancy? Like, don't you want to have a fancy, like, it's fun. You go, you have champagne at intermission. It's great.
I don't know. I guess because Americans, like, you know, even the rich Americans that came here were viewed themselves as outcasts. You know, like, that's a big complete tangent. But.
To be honest, like, it surprises a lot of people to learn that I actually hate story ballets, like Sleeping Beauty. Like, imagine, picture a ballet, and you're probably picturing a ballet I would not sit through. Like, tutus and, you know, all of the storybook princesses and all that. Like, I don't give a fuck about swans.
You know what ballet I'd sit through?
What?
Point Break.
Oh my god, that would be amazing.
That one's got all the elements to be an amazing.
That would be amazing.
The part where he shoots the guns. Like, that'd be a fucking amazing.
Let's make that happen.
Or like a Point Break ballet or a Lethal Weapon ballet.
We should have gone to the Point Break bar.
I didn't know there was a Point
there
Break
is.
Bar.
There is.
I saw. I can't go off on Point Break. We'll be here for 7 hours.
In any case.
I love Point Break.
I like abstract ballet. That is, it's about visualizing the music. There's no tutus, there's no sets, there's no princes and princesses. It's literally just about music and movement. The end.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I'm a visual artist. I'm all right with things not sort of being tethered to three-act structure or whatever. You know, storytelling's not necessarily like...
It evokes a mood.
And that can be
rather
a
than telling... Yeah, exactly.
I think the real answer to why I would suspect people don't find ballet as interesting is because the narrative is harder.
It is. There's this whole weird language of pantomime. It's bullshit. They need to... And the contemporary artists are not... circulated, like, people don't understand that it's not all about 19th century, like, you know, czars.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are contemporary choreographers making really interesting ballets, but I don't know, like, there's this idea that the Nutcracker is all anybody wants. It drives me crazy.
See, the thing about team sports, especially football, is football is very narrative, and the goals are simple.
like, even if the strategy, I almost said strategery, even if the strategy is complex, the goals seem simple. You go from one end to the other.
Right.
You prevent that guy from going one end to the other.
Right? Okay, here's my question about football. So you memorize all of these plays, right?
Yes.
Like you're on your team, and you all have to work together. It's like choreography, right?
Yes.
You all have like, but what if the other team doesn't do the choreography that you need them to do your play?
That is exactly what the game is.
Right. So what do you do?
You improvise.
Okay. So as a spectator, when they improvise, like, say you're watching your favorite team and you, like, know all about them. Are you like, oh, yeah, like, they're making this shit up as they go because this other team is giving them a hard time? Like, can you see that happening?
I mean, it's presumptuous to say yes, but I think you can. Like, again, the narrative of football is pretty simple. And then the ways in which you go from one end of the field to the other are what make it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is sort of like control. It's controlled violence in a way that, like, I had a hard problem. I had a big problem with. I had a real moment where I had to realize that, like, I needed to reconsider the violence in football as being a negative thing. Because nowadays, a lot of people, again, it's much like the comic book thing, people my age are a little more protective about certain things being theirs culturally. And a lot of what football used to be centered about was being, it will always be inherent in the game, is being tough.
Right.
Being like what, these things that are considered masculine, even if they're not.
Traumatic brain injury is
yes.
very masculine.
And I used to hate MMA sports because I used to say the MMA stuff. I still don't like MMA.
Yeah.
But I used to use MMA as an example of a thing that was almost barbaric because in boxing, the whole idea is to retain a sense of self-control. Like, there's certain places you can't hit the person, for example.
Yeah.
And there's certain ways you can't hit the person. And I think MMA has, I don't really watch it, but I think they've made an effort to change that and be more like boxing in that regard.
Listen, if you like traumatic brain injury sports, have you considered gymnastics?
Right. What I'm saying is football, the things that I used to be like, no, that's just a legal, tough, hard hit.
Yeah.
I've now realized the results of those things cost people their lives.
Yeah.
And that the people who oftentimes are in charge of, or who make the profit off that, lost the most, don't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy who's...
There's always another one. There's always more football players.
The guy who's playing the hardest out there and willing to put his head down and suffer that brain trauma for his team deserves a lot of money because that team makes a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And people are entertained by it. And he might go to the hospital tomorrow.
So that
never
is...
Never walk again or whatever.
That is what enabled the national team doctor to sexually abuse hundreds of athletes in gymnastics.
The narrowing of someone's opportunity.
The idea that you had to, that like you were replaceable and that, you know, it was like for this greater good and that your suffering wasn't that bad, like all of this.
That's a thing that I think is what Southern Bastards is about. On some level, is someone manipulating that power.
Yeah.
And being manipulated by it as well.
Why is it so hard to just make a book with no crossovers? Just no crossovers. None. Zero. Just like, because okay, if you look at like prose fiction, for example, or especially young adult fiction, there are book series that have, like, you know, 20 books in the series. Like, you can have a far-reaching series, but why, like, the Hunger Games never had a Twilight crossover. You don't need to do it.
I don't have an answer for you. I just feel like I think things should be able to, that it's big enough that there can be both.
That's actually a good point.
I think that, like, there should be, you know, if you're wading into the Marvel Universe, for example, you more than likely also enjoy the movies to some extent. And those are nothing but crossovers. And those are one ongoing television show that is like you get 6 episodes of a year, you know? The history of Marvel, for example, has always been about these things interacting and pushing together. And there's a model at which they can justify it sells more. But I also think that, like, things like Squirrel Girl remain more of an entry point for people by being a thing that is singularly in its own way.
Yeah, it's comprehensible, you know? I mean, if you tell someone... I think that an interesting character to talk about in terms of entry point is a character like Loki, which is the wildly popular character movies.
Yeah.
But if you want to get into Loki from a comics perspective, that's messy.
It's probably beyond messy.
You know? You just have to make a decision that you're going to just not know thing. You're just going to have to start at a point where you're not going to know anything and read for a while.
You know, people's ideas about all this are sort of meant to be fractured in some way. You know, I think it's rather than focusing on, you know, just like everybody else, I tend to focus on why can't things be better.
Sure.
But it is kind of miraculous to me that I live in a day and age where I can go to the, you know, the toy aisle and see Black Panther masks and Black Widow toys. And
somebody gave me a Spider-Gwen pin at Free Comic Book Day.
Yeah. And, you know, I just think I'm hopeful that it's all just growing pains. That the people who, and that maybe comics as an environment is just reflective of the world right now, and that as the world gets better, maybe people will learn to coexist a little better.
I'm so optimistic.
I mean, what other fucking choice do I have?
I mean, there's other choices. They're just not that optimistic.
Well, the one thing I'll say, you know, is that I was optimistic when I was at my lowest. So it's a thing that I have tried to retain, you know. When I was at my worst is when I felt like I was owed something. And, you know, that was a time in my mid-20s when, without going into the, it's available to the world if they want to, I've written about it at length, but I sort of had a breakdown in my mid-20s. And then I only started taking comics seriously because it was like, this is do or die. So for the first few years of that, I was a raging asshole. And not a person who was trying to actively have people dislike him, but who was basically like, this is sink or swim for me, and if you're not treating it that way, then I can't have you around me.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I stepped on so many toes and like hurt so many feelings that, like, it really took me being humbled by the process of it and moving here and having nothing compared to what I expected to gain any appreciation for it, you know?
I'm glad this place is good for something.
I think you'll... Who knows, man? Even if it was good for you to appreciate whatever's next for you more, then maybe. It will have been,
I mean,
good
it made
you.
Me appreciate home, which is LA.
Sure. Oh, God.
Hey. Hey, now.
I'm just... There's at least... I've spent a lot more time in L.A. the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And I used to date a girl that was an actress that lived in L.A.
Okay, actresses are a different thing.
No, and I living there, actually, like, and watching what she had to deal with all the time. She was a beautiful, talented woman who was just forced rejection all the time. And that really, like, opened my eyes in a weird way. And, but to this day, like, the last time I went back was last summer.
Yeah.
And I had one of the best times I've ever had in Los Angeles.
It's great.
And I still, at least once a day, was like, fuck this place!
No. Okay, I grew up in a place where you could take surfing as your gym class in my high school.
Sure.
That's how close I grew up to the beach.
Okay. That's weird. Nobody's supposed to have cool shit like that in high school.
I remember very vividly me and my best friend in high school.
No idea.
We would get very dressed up in our goth finery, and we would go to the beach at like 2 o'clock in the morning and dig a big hole and just go to sleep. I would sleep at the beach.
Are you trying to tell me you were like some kind of beach vampire?
Yes. Yes. In fact, most people thought we were like lesbian beach vampires.
When I was a kid,
yes.
I was fucking terrified of vampires.
Were you?
And there's no
Why?
Reason to ever be terrified of vampires.
No, because they're sexy.
Also, there's no consequence.
Well, they kill you.
Not really.
It depends on the vampire lore. Which mythology are we working with here?
But if I get bit by a vampire and I get to live forever, I fucking won.
But is it the kind where if they bite you and drain all your blood, then you die unless they put their own blood back into you? Because then they have to pick you.
Can they put barbecue sauce back in you? Can I?
The barbecue vampire.
Can it be filled with barbecue sauce?
No, you cannot.
You can find Jason on Twitter at Jason Latour. You can find me on Twitter at Portrait of Madame X. And you can find the show on Twitter at IRCB Podcast. You should also check out our Goodreads group, where we have weekly threads, a monthly show, discussions, things like that. Our website is IRCBpodcast.com, where you can find all of the episodes, links to all of this stuff, as well as merch and our zine. Please rate the show, subscribe, tell your friends. You can email us at ircb@destroythesybe.org. Thank you to Infinity Shred. They are the best. They do the music for the show. Thank you also to Jason for the chat and for helping get the audio together. Thank you to Xander, the audio wizard, who helped me edit the show. And thanks to Mike, our podcast producer extraordinaire. And of course, thank you for listening.